view your estate or long-term financial plans, please remember you can include KPFT. Ensure your commitment to public broadcasting continues on. With the help of your attorney, a bequest is simple to put in place. If you need help or have questions, call our development director at 713-526-4000. Again, that's 713-526-4000. Please join listeners like you in helping to ensure that the independent voice of KPFT will be preserved for generations to come. Name KPFT as a beneficiary in your will today. This is KPFT Houston.
Signals Thursday, 8 p.m. in time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host, and alongside the talented team of Hank Rubicek, Greg Aldell, Mary Edgerton, Tatiana Gago, and guest hosts Eric Heen, Christy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who engage us with stirring personal stories, treasured folk tales, and riveting historical remembrances. Each week we'll take you on captivating journeys, and then we'll bring you safely home. Every once in a while we like to do a show that simply reminds us of the joy of storytelling, the ways that stories help us connect with one another, and how storytelling is just plain fun. As we approach the holidays, stories become more important than ever in bringing us together with those we love. If you're of a certain age, you'll recall that there was once a best-selling book called The Joy of Cooking, and that was a glorified name for a cookbook, and it was a best-selling cookbook at that, and I've used it about 1,000 times. But that was followed by an even bigger bestseller, The Joy of Sex, which I suppose you could say had a few recipes as well. In honor of those achievements, I'm calling tonight's show The Joy of Storytelling. Tonight you'll hear a story by a young man about a young man trying to figure out how to smoke marijuana for the first time. Of course, without getting caught or killed. Isn't the devil always in the details? And you'll hear a story about a different kind of high, a hiking in the mountains of Peru. And then we'll hear a story about a crazy nurse and a crazy evening in a rather crazy nursing home. And then we'll circle back to the teenage years and visit a different type of cuckoo's nest, a summer church camp where even more crazy things happen. One of my guest tellers for tonight's show is a first-timer on KPFT, and the other is a seasoned veteran. Sid Darr and Brendan Bork-Deal, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
We're delighted you're both here, and we're going to have a great show. Sid, you're the newbie, so I'd like to start with you. In your bio, being the good husband that you are, you described yourself as, quote, an enthusiastic audience member at the Moth, where his wife, Sneha Desai, is an active storyteller. Well, I agree. Your wife, who just happened to be sitting right behind me, is pretty amazing, but from what I've heard, you're pretty amazing too. What is it about storytelling that appeals to you?
Well, I really just enjoy listening to all these different experiences that people have. It's just, you know, for that brief moment, you get to vicariously experience something that you may not be able to in real life, and that is very appealing to me.
I love that. That speaks to the empathy that's involved in storytelling, how it enables us to get inside each other's lives and shoes. Great. I guess what I'd like you to do now is take a deep breath and relax, because I'm thinking that might get you in the mood for your first story, which is about trying marijuana for the first time.
Yeah.
And now you may exhale.
So I was born in Calcutta, a city in the eastern part of India. It used to be the capital of the British Empire.
Yes.
And still boasts of grandeur colonial architecture. Today it's famous as the adopted home of Mother Teresa and the missionaries of charity. Mm-hmm. It's also called the City of Joy, mm-hmm. A term that I never really understood till my friends told me that it was the city of ganja, or the city of hash, or the city of weed, or the city of marijuana. It all started to make sense then. So I grew up with a very strict mother, and I learned to follow her commands, mm-hmm. because she would get really angry, and it was easier just following her commands. So if she told me to sit, I just sat. If she told me to stand, I stood. If she told me to go to the bathroom and pee, I went to the bathroom and I peed, because it was easier following her commands than have to face her anger. She had a very simple rule. Come home after school. So I never really got to hang out with my friends, nor did I get to try some of the weed that they were smoking. Fast forward a few years, I moved to the U.S. for graduate school. I become more independent, and I realized that I'm a complete experience junkie. I go on multiple trips with my friends. On one such trip to Chicago, a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to try some weed. I excitedly said yes, to which he responded that he didn't have any on him. Mm-hmm. To make matters worse, he wasn't from Chicago, so he didn't have any friends who could help us either. In our moment of crisis, we turned to our trusted friend, google.com. a quick search, and we were on a website called webehigh.com.
Webehigh.com.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, it lists...
People are writing that down. Right?
Yeah, it is. It lists where you can find weed in any city globally. So we selected a neighborhood that we think we had the best chances of finding some. Our plan was simple and bulletproof. We were going to walk into a bar, make friends with a few locals, and just ask them if they had any weed on them. So we got to this dark alley in that neighborhood, and out of nowhere, these two teenagers popped right in front of us from a completely abandoned house. They were wearing baseball hats, had bloodshot red eyes, long baggy pants, and were on a skateboard. I immediately knew we had hit jackpot. I asked them, "Hey, I want to smoke what you have." One of them responded, "Are you guys cops?" I looked at him and I asked him, "Do we look like cops?" So you see, my friend and I, we're both brown, bearded, a bit scrawny. And to top it off, we both had nerdy-looking glasses. He believed us and gave us a number. We called, and 15 minutes later, we were at this dimly lit loft. This guy in his 20s greeted us. There was an aquarium by the entrance, but there were no fish in it. Instead, there was a scorpion. And on top of the aquarium was this bright neon flashing light. He showed us the different varieties that he had. He then proceeded to tell us how he scores his stuff from all around the nation. At that point in time, I realized that, you know, this was no regular middleman. This was not your friend in the college dorm trying to make an extra buck. This was a real deal, a dealer. And a real eerie feeling kicked in. If something were to go south, I knew that that scorpion would probably end up on me. So he presented me with different varieties and asked me to try some. Now, the problem is I had no idea how to. Am I supposed to roll up a joint? Though I have no clue how to do that. Am I supposed to eat this? Or is this the stuff that people shove up their noses? luckily for me, my friend knew what to do, and he smelled them, and we chose one. So we paid him paid him cash, and we took the stash. As we stepped out, cops zoomed right in front of us. So I took the packet and I hid it where I thought it was the safest, my boxers, and we just started walking briskly in the opposite direction. We got to his girlfriend's place and he showed me how to roll up a joint. And that night, for the very first time, I smoked weed. My memory after that is a bit hazy. I remember at one point in time, I was on the floor rolling with laughter. And I also remember floating with the clouds, which were on a painting in the wall in front of me. But I woke up next day feeling elated. I was an independent person. I was no longer a mama's boy. I was no longer a weed virgin. And that I had become an independent guy who had walked into a dealer's house in Chicago and bought my first stash of weed.
I love the realism of this story. I think one of the functions of stories is to document our lives, and that's exactly what you've done. And you've got some key details in there. I mean, the scorpion, that's just a perfect detail. How did you feel when you saw that scorpion?
Yeah, you don't forget those kind of details. It stays with you.
Was that scorpion there for a purpose, you think?
I think so. I think just to intimidate people, and you know, if something were to go wrong, it would come handy.
I think another function of stories is to provide a compass for the storyteller and also for the listeners in terms of maybe making better decisions in the future. When the story begins, you're living in the cocoon of your mother's home, and by the end, you're an independent adult. How would you say your character changed as you experienced what you described in the story?
I definitely think I became more independent, starting to make my own decisions. And it also opened me up to new experiences that I may have previously rejected. I was more open to these new experiences, and I think that was a key turning point for me.
So there are a lot of lessons embedded in your story. What's the single most essential message you'd like us to remember?
Well, firstly, WeBeHi is a very useful resource. But more importantly, you know, I feel like we do make these goals in our lives, and somehow the universe has its way of getting us there. You know, I didn't mean to walk into a dealer's house that night. All I really wanted to do was smoke some weed with my close friends, and the universe made it happen.
Great. If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT. You can also catch us at 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. We're online at www.kpft.org, and we're also streaming live on Facebook Live. You've just heard a story by Sid Darr. My other guest, Brendan Bork-Scheel, is a writer of plays and prose. His plays have been produced in Chicago and here in Houston at Stages Repertory Theater, one of my favorites, and the Landing Theater Company, another favorite as well. And at Landing, he serves as playwright in residence. His stories have been featured at Grown Up Storytime, The Gentle Hour, and of course on this program, where he's making his fifth appearance tonight, which is very close to being a world record. When he's not writing, he teaches at the Alley Theater and Kinder High School of Performing and Visual Arts. Five times on the show, Brendan. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Quite a lot. And you're quite young still. And our listeners are about to learn the reason we keep inviting you back. What is it about stories and storytelling that appeals to you?
I have a bunch of highfalutin answers about mirroring society queued up. But it's an excuse to talk to people for someone who has trouble doing that under normal circumstances. That's why I do it.
That's a great answer. That's the most. So what do you mean? Because you kind of, you have something to tell them. So it gives you, it helps you feel more comfortable.
Exactly. It gives me a social script to follow and some framework to figure things out within.
Yeah. Did you grow up around a lot of storytellers or?
My mom was definitely a storyteller, and my uncles, I don't think they would think of themselves as storytellers, but they definitely are.
Yeah. Well, your first story has the title, which I love, Designated Optimist. And it's a signature Brendan story because it illustrates dramedy, a blend of drama and comedy. It's about a nursing home where your mother spent the last months of her life. Tell us your story.
So it was my mom's first day at this new nursing home, and I was pretty nervous about the place because it didn't seem that great from the outside. It kind of looked like if Ozzy Osbourne were a building, just grimy and ready to collapse at any second. And when I walked in, I immediately saw like stuffing coming out of the furniture and plaster flaking from the ceiling. But there was this bird in the lobby, this cockatiel. And I was like, oh, cool, my mom likes birds. I wonder if this one talks. So I sat next to this old lady who was trying to, like, coax it into speaking. And after, like, 20 minutes of cajoling, she eventually got it to say a couple of words. And one of the words that this bird said was, help! Which did not seem like a great sign of what this place might portend. And I quickly discovered why this bird knew the word help. It's because this facility was home to lots of patients with late-stage dementia. Mm-hmm. And patients with dementia will often wake up not knowing where they are, not knowing when they are, and they'll start calling for help, and that'll wake up other patients with dementia who will also start calling for help. And so it sets off this chain reaction in the building, and you can go help them, but oftentimes they'll forget you were there the second you leave, and they'll just start right back up again. So at any time of the day or night in this facility, there was a constant chorus of people calling for help. And this constant state of low-level alert, I think, is part of what made everyone who worked there this kind of burnt-out shell who really seemed to be overworked and overwhelmed and to really hate their job and to really hate anyone who dared to ask them for help, with the exception of one staff member. There was this nurse whose name was Marjorie, and she seemed to have the unofficial job title of designated optimist. She basically stood out in this place like a Tigger in a world full of Eeyores. She had this snow-white Disney princess energy packed into neon pink scrubs. And every day she would just kind of ping-pong around the facility, passing out muffins and spearheading arts and crafts projects. She was a really wonderful person, one of the most magnanimous people I've ever met. I hated her more than anything in the world. I'll tell you why. Here's why. Imagine, over the course of 8 months, you watched your mom go from being a fully functional adult with a car and a job to eating pureed chicken with a rubber fork and wearing a diaper. And imagine nobody ever took you aside to tell you this, but you were beginning to put it together that she was not going to get better. And imagine that midway through you realizing that and wading into your new dark normal, Elmo from Sesame Street kicked down your door with a boombox in one hand and a disco ball in the other and started trying to teach you how to do the Macarena. That's what Marjorie's presence in my life at that moment felt like. It was intrusive. Her positivity was like invalidating to the negativity that I was learning to deal with. But I realized I had no right to be mad at her because she was amazing at her job and my mom loved her. And in a world full of illness and burnouts and creepy talking birds, you can't afford to turn your back on the one source of niceness. So I told myself, whatever this is, you have to get over it and you have to let this person know that she's valued and she's seen by you. So that's what I did. But I just picked a really terrible time to do it. The night I decided to thank Marjorie was the night that this massive storm hit. It was like a flash flood. And I think other than maybe Harvey and I guess now Imelda, it was the worst storm in my recent memory. And what was crazy about it was how quickly things went south. Like one minute the sky was kind of cloudy and the next minute every car had been forced onto the shoulder of the road. And the wind was sending these sheets of rain crashing into the building to the point where it felt like there was like a medieval army outside trying to like batter down our doors. And all the mayhem outside, as you might imagine, started to foment a similar kind of mayhem inside. That constant chorus of people calling for help, it started to grow in intensity and severity, and it started to make its way all the way around the building until everywhere there were people calling for help. At one point, this really confused old man wandered into my mom's room, and he sat down on the bed opposite hers, and we were like, hi, and he didn't say anything. So we all just sat there watching Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, hoping everything would still be okay in the morning. And then after 40 minutes of storming, this crack started forming in the lobby wall. and it kept growing, and the staff had to pull all the furniture out of that part of the building and use it to barricade entry to the lobby because they were afraid the roof was going to collapse. And I realized, if this happens, if the roof caves in, a lot of these people can't exactly run for cover. And the water on the roads is too high for the ambulance to get to us anytime soon, so this could get really life or death really fast. And I guess I wasn't the only one who realized this, because this is when the pandemonium started to peak. And the way it started to peak was that a bunch of residents, pretty much everyone who wasn't bedbound, started congregating in the dining hall, and they all started calling for help all at once and sort of feeding off of each other's energy until they had sort of gotten all swept up in this big cacophonous mass of pain and need. Only thing I can think to compare it to in my entire mental Rolodex is an image of a Tyson chicken factory. It was that chaotic and that bleak. And I watched one staff member look at this mob and go, uh-uh, and make a beeline for the break room. And I was like, oh my God, who's going to help these people? And then I saw Marjorie just in the middle of it all, having like dove into it like a paratrooper. And she was just bouncing from one patient to the next with like no signs of slowing down, even in the least. She was like, hey there, Mrs. Austin, can I help you? Hey there, Mrs. Julius, can I help you? Hey there, Mrs. Austin, can I help you again? Hey there, Mrs. Julius, can I help you again? It was like watching Bill Murray at the end of Groundhog Day, when he's like fully embraced the absurdity of the situation in which he's trapped with this zen-like mastery that's like somewhere on the border of heroism and madness. So I felt like I had to say something to her. I had to tell her that that's one of the most heroic things I'd ever seen. So when she finally got this crowd quiet enough that she could visit my mom's room, I said, listen, Marjorie, you've been really incredible tonight. And she was like, psh, oh, stop. And I realized it was probably going to be hard to get her to take a compliment. So I kind of got in her way. And I said, no, listen, hey, I know you don't get thanked a lot in this job. I know you get yelled at and spit at and you get things thrown at you. And I know a lot of the people who you take care of can't even remember your name. But for what it's worth, I remember it. And for what you've done for my mom, I always will. And for maybe the first time ever, I watched the smile flicker out of Marjorie's eyes, and she started to tear up, and I was like, oh, wow, I guess she really needed to hear that. But then the tear, it started to escalate into full-on sobbing, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess she really, really needed to hear that. And then the sobbing escalated into what I guess you would call a tantrum. Like, she basically collapsed in my mom's chair, and she started letting loose these biblically eerie moans that were like halfway between a banshee and a dying orca whale. I'll try to replicate it. It was like, and I was like, what did I do? It's like my floodgate, you know, my words opened up this floodgate, and now this current of pure liquefied despair was like jetting out of her face with an intensity that matched the outside storms. And I thought, oh my God, I broke Marjorie. This is really bad. And none of us knew what to do, so we all just sort of sat there and let her go for a while. Me, my mom, the random old guy who had wandered in. And in between her sobs, every once in a while on TV, we'd hear Guy Fieri go, Flavor Town. And then after a couple minutes, she just got up and she wordlessly sulked out of there. And that was the last time I saw her that night. And for a long time after, I wondered why the things I said did what they did to her. And my theory is this. In order to work in an environment like that, and to stay as relentlessly positive as she was, a person has to engage in a heavy amount of reality avoidance. You kind of have to walk through the world with blinders on. I think Marjorie had built for herself this kind of invisible pair of sugar-coated glasses that were her protection from the hostility of her world. And what I had done with my little speech was rip those glasses off her face and force her to stare into the unfiltered reality of her existence. It was basically like taking off an astronaut's helmet in deep space. And maybe the craziest thing about this is the next day, she didn't even acknowledge it. Like, I walked up to her, I was about to apologize. She put a hand on my chest, and as she was walking past me, she said, hey there, sunshine. And then she just left. And the subtext of hey there, sunshine to me was, please, would you just let me have my world? so I did.
Was that her way of saying thank you?
You know, that's the furthest thing from my mind is the idea that she would thank me for that, but I appreciate that you thought that. Yeah, I'd like to check in with her now, see how she's doing, but I don't have the nerve, and I feel like it'd be pretty weird to go back there. Mm-hmm. So hopefully she hears this.
Yeah. Marjorie, if you're out there, Brendan's designated optimist, your story is powerful on a couple of levels. The way you hold the drama and the comedy together, I mean, this is a tender moment in your life. You're dealing with the demise and death of your mother, and it's happening so fast right before your eyes. Mm. But the way you tell the story, you focused in on one moment in that whole 6 months where you give a compliment to Marjorie. Mm-hmm. And how she responds. But in that vortex or whatever the word is, you know, everything is poured. We know, we can kind of infer everything else from that. Why did you pick that moment as a way of talking about your grief, really, about your mom?
I had to pick someone to talk about other than myself or my mom, or I wouldn't be able to do this in a cogent way. Mm-hmm. Maybe I would, but I would need a book to do it.
Yeah.
In order to distill the story into someone else, I had to focus on a third party. And Marjorie is just sort of a perfect embodiment of so much of the world that my mom experienced while she was sick.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a sad moment in your life. It's a great story about that. It really helps the rest of us understand what you were going through, what it was like for Marjorie as a caregiver there, and just the juxtaposition of the bird and Marjorie. Just mm-hmm. that alone to me was a couple of perfect details to paint the picture of what the setting was like. Thank you for that story.
Thank you.
This is Warren Holloman. You're listening to Storytellers, Brendan Borkshiel and Sid Darr on 90.1 FM KPFT. I'm going to give Brendan and Sid a chance to catch their breaths. And while they do that, we're going to check in with Tatiana. And she's going to give us this week's storytelling calendar.
So let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. You know, it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. You know, and they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. That's located at 1500 Sunset. Their next swap is going to be November 26th. And we know that November is a busy month because on Saturday, November 23rd, the country will celebrate Telebration. Celebrate with the Houston Storytellers Guild at the Black Lab at 7 p.m. and enjoy some of the best tellers in the state. Details about this event and everything you want to know is on www.HoustonStorytellers.org.
And Tatiana, I typed 7 p.m., but actually I think they start at 6 p.m.
6 p.m.?
Yeah.
And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member? You know, it's really easy to do online. Also, while you're there, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 is listed there right under menu radio program. And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem because you can listen to a stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube. And I guess you can say we're all over the place. And why not visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page? Learn about the show, offer your comments and program suggestions, and share it with your friends. We'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. Also, if you want to tell us why you'd be a great guest, drop us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at The Moth, where you'll enjoy terrific stories, which is the second Tuesday of every month at Warehouse Live. The next slam is next week, November 12th, and the theme is gratitude.
Thanks, Tatiana. And I'm going to add one more item. Last night at the match, there were two screenings of a new film that I think our listeners would be very interested in. It's called For Art's Sake, and it's going to be rescreened, I think, several more times, but the one I know about is next Sunday, November 17th, at Rice Cinema as part of the Houston Cinema Arts Festival. This is the world premiere of a film by Michael Zapata and Andrew Benavides, and it's about our friend here on the show, of one who's been a guest here several times, Ben DeSoto. He's one of Houston's truly great photographers, and I would just say citizens of Houston. He developed some health issues. He no longer lives in Houston, but he's back in town for a couple of weeks. And I know he'd love to see you. He's going to be at the events, and they'll do some talkbacks. I had the privilege of spending a lot of time with him back in the 90s when he was documenting the Houston homeless situation. And I was working with a homeless outreach program, and he would go out with us. And I was just so amazed at how respectful he was of the people he photographed and how it was not about his ego, but it was about telling a story through pictures. And the people he photographed just loved him, and he got to know them, and he would go out not just once or twice, but he practically lived out there and documented that emerging situation in Houston at that time. With that, I guess we're back now for the second half of our show and more stories from Sid Darr and Brendan Bork-Scheel. Sid, your first story was about an ordeal you went through in order to get high. Mm-hmm. Your second story is about a different kind of high. Tell us your story.
Yep. So as an introvert who loves to spend time outdoors, I'm the happiest when I am hiking. So when my friends started to persuade me to go on a hiking trip to Peru, I was slightly hesitant. While the idea was sounded really good, I wasn't in the best of shapes. After much contemplation, I decided to take the plunge. For those who don't know, Peru is famous for some challenging Inca trails. We did some research and we decided to hike up the Choqquequirau ruins, also known as the Cradle of Gold. It's not as touristy as the famous Inca trail to Machu Picchu, but it's just as physically challenging. At its peak, it goes to a high elevation of almost 15,000 feet above sea level. This was going to be one of the most challenging physical activities I'd ever undertaken. Once I booked my tickets to Peru, I had about 2 months to prepare for my trip. From there on, I started doing this routine at the gym. I would do high-intensity workouts, going up and down 30 flights of stairs at my office work building, and I also started using an oxygen mask to help me acclimatize to the high elevation. The journey to Cusco, which is a city in Peru, which acts as the international gateway to the ruins, was quite eventful. I almost lost my luggage, but that's a story for another time. I did eventually make it to Cusco with my luggage, and my friends and I, we found a local guide who would take us to the ruins the next day at the crack of dawn. Day one of the hike was stunningly beautiful. As I basked in the glory of dusty trails in the first half and lush green surroundings in the second, I was so grateful for the company of my friends. I was also amazed by the number of dogs that I met along the way. Though they were stray, they were very friendly. A lot of my time spent petting them and taking pictures with them. Day two, we continued our journey towards Choqquequirau. This was going to be a very challenging day. We had to ascend almost 6,000 feet in a relatively short distance. As I got to the top of the mountains, I felt this strong shooting pain in my right knee. I somehow made it to the top. The view was completely worth it, truly. Being in the middle of clouds, looking over the ruins, the immense river valleys, the 16,000 plus foot hills around me was completely magical. In that moment, I completely forgot about my pain. But reality hit soon. I had to walk down, and I realized that my knee was in a really bad shape. I woke up next day knowing that I couldn't go down on my own. As much as my ego resisted the idea, I knew I had to find a mule and go down on the mule. Our guide told me that I had to go down at least 2 hours by foot, and I had to get there early to maximize my chances of finding a guide with an extra mule. You know what they say about the early bird catches a worm? It was kind of like that. The early weakling climbs a mule kind of a situation. Needless to say, my journey was extremely challenging. Imagine walking down a steep slope. Now imagine doing that with a knee that has given up on you.
Yeah.
At one point, I was faced with the decision of choosing a pathway. Under normal circumstances, I would just open up my phone and turn to my trusted friend Google Maps. but I didn't have the liberty to do that, nor did I find a single human soul around me to help.
Right.
I was lost, I was alone, and I was in excruciating pain. I started questioning if I had made the right decision to come on this hiking trip and started having existential issues. As I fought my tears, I heard some footsteps, or rather, paw steps. Out of nowhere, this dog showed up as if to tell me, "You don't need Google Maps, you have me."
Oh.
I started petting the dog, and as amazing the dogs are, I think he realized that I was in pain. He started to lick me. This act of affection reminded me of my loving dog, Coda, back home. I mustered the courage to get up and start my journey. The only problem was I still didn't know which way to go. Mm-hmm. Fortunately for me, my new friend knew what to do, and I just followed him. And shortly after, we bumped into some tourists who confirmed that I was on the right path. After almost 2 hours, I miraculously made it to the campsite. I walked in, and I just collapsed. As I lay on the grass, the dog came by me, exposed his belly as if to ask me, "Hey, mister, where's my payment?" as I was giving him some belly rubs, few English-speaking tourists came to the campsite and they helped me secure a guide with a mule. After that, the trip was quite uneventful. I made it to the base camp. I never saw the dog again, and I often wonder what would have happened if I hadn't met the dog, or is the dog still walking up Chokikirao hiking trail and helping other lost tourists? You know, it always amazes me how much unconditional love dogs can give.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people ask me about this trip, and what I remember the most is the companionship that I had.
Wow. I love the way you use details and animals in your stories. The first story, the scorpion appeared at a pivotal moment mm-hmm. in this drama and was kind of a symbol of something and created quite an atmosphere for the listener. You painted a picture for the listener. And then here at a similar moment where you may be in trouble, you're afraid, you're hurt, in pain, physical and emotional and spiritual, this dog appears and it turns the story in a different direction than the scorpion.
Yeah, I'm really indebted to the dog, and so fortunate that he found me, really.
Yeah. Your story, I think the right word is a hero's journey, except the hardest part isn't, there's all that goes into climbing the mountain, training, being with your friends, doing the training, doing the work, doing the preparation, and then the heroes climb the mountain. They receive the award of this unbelievably beautiful view that very few people in the world have ever seen. But then the hardest part of your journey, it takes a turn that I didn't expect. The hardest part isn't getting up the mountain, it's getting down.
Yes, I agree. You know, I often feel that, you know, life, there are lots of choices that we make, and going up the mountaintop is a choice that I made. But once I was at the top, I didn't really have a choice. I had to come down. There was no options. And to me, life is kind of similar, where we make these choices, but at some point, there are reactions and repercussions of the choices that we can't really control. We just have to deal with it and go with it.
Yeah. We were talking before the show about our pets, and I would be remiss if I didn't give you a chance to tell our listeners about Coda, the canine Yoda.
Yes, yeah, so we rescued Coda about 5 years ago. In reality, he rescued us. Right around that time, my wife, Sneha, had been diagnosed with a chronic pain condition, and Coda really helped her in her journey of recovery. He's still here with us, and anytime we have any physical or emotional challenges, he's always by our side. He is also a social media influencer. he has about...
Hank, are you taking notes in there?
he has more than 11,000 followers on Instagram. His name is Coda the Canine Yoda. Even with this Insta-famous status of him, he still is very humble about it.
Oh, good for your life has a recurring theme: dogs that rescue you.
Yes,
that's really nice. Well, for the final segment of the show, we're going to circle back to Brendan one more time. Brendan, your first story was, of course, about a nursing home and some of the craziness that went on there. Your second story is about a different kind of institution. It's a summer church camp, obviously not for older people, but for younger people. But I suspect we're going to hear about some craziness that went on there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe one of the strangest things about this camp was how normal it seemed when I first got there. Like, it was like they had copy-pasted the camp from every movie about a summer camp into reality. And that's what I expected. I figured, you know, like, by the end of the summer, I would either have a girlfriend or get murdered by a guy in a hockey mask, excited for either possibility. And looking back on it, there were some red flags that might have pointed an older, wiser me to the reality that it was run by hardcore Christian fundamentalists. One of those red flags, I pulled out my copy of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, and a couple kids jumped like three steps back like it was radioactive.
Oh my gosh.
I had a yin-yang necklace that one kid kept telling me was the sign of the devil and that I should destroy it. Not stop wearing it, destroy it. Like he wanted me to go throw it into Mount Doom. And then probably the biggest giveaway in hindsight was that we sang lots and lots of gospel rock, the kind that's really repetitive and excessively upbeat and kind of sounds like it's being made up on the spot, where every chorus is like, yes, Lord, holy, holy, yes, Lord, something, something, Jesus, he's dead. It's like, wait, he's dead. Why are you so happy? So, yeah, all of these things in hindsight might have alerted an older, wiser me to the fact that I was not in the situation I thought I was in. But as a nine-year-old, they just went over my head.
Yeah.
And maybe my parents should have realized something was up, but in their defense, this camp did not really play up their spirituality from the start. They didn't hide the fact that they were Christian, but they didn't lead with it either. I think this was by design. I think the strategy was, make sure by the time you get down to the business of soul-saving, everyone's defenses are lowered, everyone's guard is dropped. So for the first 3 days that we were at camp, it was basically a montage of like run-of-the-mill fun camp hijinks. It was like sports relay races, water balloon fights. I liked to show off how quickly I could chug apple juice, so every morning I would drink enough sugar to kill Wilford Brimley. And then on the evening of the third night, sports camp made this hard left turn into church camp. The way it happened was we all gathered in this big outdoor space called the sanctuary, another red flag. Mm-hmm. And normally during this time of night, we'd watch like a skit or we would jam out to Christian rock. But on this night, all the lights cut and this eerie, echoey ballad started playing over the sound system. And this single spotlight came up on stage on a guy with his hands stretched out to his sides, his head hung, his legs crossed, unmistakable crucifixion pose. And he started lip-syncing to the song that was playing, like really soulfully lip-syncing, like Jesus Christ Superstar. And a couple people would always like laugh at this visual, but then the counselors would shame them into silence really quickly, like to let them know, no, we're not having fun anymore, this is serious. And I don't remember the lyrics of the song. I just remember it was incredibly obnoxiously long. It was like the Stairway to Heaven of creepy Christian ballads. And so we would all watch this guy for like 9 or 10 minutes. And then from the back of the room, just as we were getting completely entranced by it, the trance was broken by this big thud. And we'd all whip our little necks around and we'd see three guys dressed in red and camouflage. And they had at their feet a much smaller guy dressed in white. And they picked him up and they threw him down and then they said, get up. And he tried to get up and they backhanded him back down again. And then they started to drag him down the center aisle towards the stage. And every step of the way, they would punch him, kick him, yell at him, spit on him. I realize, in hindsight, they had to have been choreographing this. It wasn't like a real fight. But in my memory, it's as real as any act of violence I've ever witnessed. Like, I remember the sound of bone hitting bone. I remember air leaving this guy's body. I remember tears in his eyes as his face got dragged on the floor past me where I sat cross-legged, feeling not completely safe. The guys in red and camo pantomimed nailing him up next to the guy who was lip-syncing, and then they spit on him and exited, and the last thing we saw was the lights going down on these two guys pretending to be crucified. And then our counselors wordlessly got up and led us out into the woods. We weren't allowed to talk. We went out to these campfires that were already lit, and we sat around them, and they'd give us a speech, the details of which changed from year to year, but the bottom line was always the same. Accept Jesus Christ as your Savior or burn in hell. And I remember one year this counselor was like, now, you don't have to do it right now, but for all you know, on the way back to camp, you could get bit by a snake. You could have an aneurysm. People die from aneurysms all the time, even kids. Like, if they had been any less subtle, it would have been a mafia shakedown. Like, listen, buddy, accidents happen all the time. Tomorrow, your face could run into my foot over and over until you're dead. If you haven't accepted Jesus Christ as your Savior, what do you think happens to you? So again, I'd like to think it wouldn't work on an older, wiser me, but 9-year-old me was like, sold, what do I have to do? I got down on my knees. I was like, Jesus, I've been a terrible sinner. I read the Harry Potter series, but that was before I knew you had access to a lake of fire. I'm going to be cool now, I promise. Just please come into my heart, save me. And when I said that, I actually felt, this is not like, you know, poetic license, I actually felt this physical feeling of tension leaving my body and this calm, cool wave wrapping around me. And in the years that followed, I watched other kids have the same physiological reaction to converting. And the last year I was there, my entire cabin got swept up in this hysteria of laugh crying. And a counselor told us, this is what God feels like, guys. That's what I resent the most about everything that happened there. Because I could never get that feeling back when I left camp. And now I know why. It's because that feeling was programmed into my head. It was a chemical cocktail of like stress hormones and endorphins that was a reaction to watching a guy get beat up and then being given a hellfire speech. But at the time, I thought my inability to recapture that feeling meant there was something wrong with me. Like, I didn't really believe and I wasn't really saved. And as a teenager, I grew into this confused, disillusioned agnostic. I started to think back on those nights at camp that I had been so grateful for when they happened, and I started to realize that what the counselors had done was a little messed up. But I didn't realize how mad I really was about the whole thing until college, when I got invited to this church's movie night. It was one of those classic bait and switches that college churches do, where they show up at your campus and they give you flyers that say, like, this is just going to be a night of totally a-religious socialization. And then you get there and they bait and switch you. I showed up, you know, like many college kids, I put my discomfort with religion aside for the promise of free pizza. I went to this place, I mingled, I watched a movie. After the movie was over, this pastor got up in front of the screen and he went, wow, Babe is a really powerful film, isn't it? That part where he saves the sheep always gets to me. And I was like, wait a minute, saves the sheep? He's not about to. And he goes, hey, Speaking of saving the sheep, let's talk about another famous shepherd. And the second I realized where he was going with this, I was like, oh, no, I'm out. Sorry, gotta go. And they had indignant, you know, they had like, they'd seated me in the middle of a row, so I had to like angrily shimmy past a bunch of people. But that didn't slow me down. As I'm on the way out the door, the pastor's like, is something wrong, son? And I'm like, no, come on. You know exactly what you're doing. It's been done to me before, and frankly, it's been done better. I think you guys are being incredibly hypocritical. I think this is manipulative. You're supposed to be the good guys. This isn't what Jesus would do. I'm done listening to people like you. I'm out of here. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't say any of that. The only thing I could think to say of in the moment was, thanks for the pizza. And then I stormed out of there. But as I was walking back to my dorm, I felt years of tension leaving my body. And I felt this strange but oddly familiar calm, cool wave start to wrap around me. And honestly, it kind of felt like that same feeling I got back at church camp, the one I'd never been able to get back and the one that I'd hated myself for not feeling again. I think whatever stood in the way of me feeling it again was gone, and it felt good.
Oh, goodness. That story took us on a journey, and thank you for that, for your story. I loved it. Having grown up in church camps myself, a lot of that resonated. Thank you. What would you like our listeners to take from your story?
You know, I think about that story as a theater maker now, because that's like basically what they did. They put on a little children's theater play for us, and they made the mistake that everyone makes when they make bad children's theater. They treated the kids like idiots who can't be trusted to make the right decision on their own, so you have to like lead them to it. That's the takeaway, I guess, if I have to pick one. Try not to treat kids like idiots. Try to trust that they're smart little people who will figure things out.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't manipulate them, whether they're children or adults. What? So we talked about how Sid's first story was a coming-of-age story, the one about smoking marijuana for the first time. I don't want to read too much into this, but what lessons did you learn about through this that maybe helped make shape your character or maybe make you a better person in the long run?
I think one thing that this camp started for me was a path to becoming militantly undogmatic. That's the thing I'm dogmatic about, is being undogmatic. And that's what I take into the classroom when I teach. I'm always proceed from a point of view of, I don't know anything for certain. I'm going to try to point you students to what I believe is the right answer, but I don't know, and maybe you know. And that's always been how I operate, for better and for worse, and it has a lot to do with this camp and the certainty that they instilled in me early.
Yeah, I love it. Sid, any comments about this story or Brendan's other story?
Yeah, you know, I often find, you know, religions across the world, Christianity, Hinduism, and so on, they were all really meant to spread love, and so you can love one another. But over the years, a lot of actors and organizations use it in a malicious way, use it to manipulate people, and it's consistent across the globe, and it's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, it sure is. Tatiana, Hank, your thoughts?
Well, it just seems like all from both of your stories, from all that were told tonight, they're all really strange situations that create like a great story.
Yeah, bravo, guys. These are really wonderful stories. You know, somebody once told me many years ago that that most stories is about trying to get home, literally or symbolically, peace, tranquility, freedom, love. You know, and that's what I thought about with Sid's dog, the compass. That's the first thing that I thought about. And Brendan's stories do the same thing. You know, there's this thing called the dramaturgical model, and it's a model about storytelling, and it speaks to the way stories are reflections of our lives on stage, which endorses the likelihood of humor and drama, which is, Warren, what you were talking about when you were talking about the signature Brendan style. It's what Mark Twain says when he says that, show me someone who knows what's funny and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fusion of those two emotions that both of these gentlemen, I think, did so well. Great show. Thank you.
Hank, just as an aside, have you ever noticed how many stories we've had on this show about church summer camps?
There's been a lot. Has been a lot. You know, I want to say over the years, maybe a couple of dozen at least. And not only church camps, but we've had some Jewish people on who talked about synagogue camps, which are identical. They're identical. They're the same thing. Everybody hates them. I went to one. I hated mine for the same reason. There's just something about them that is not fun. And you're supposed to have fun at camps. They're in the summer. You're not in school. And I remember when I was at those camps, all I wanted to do was to go back to school. That's not a really great message when you're nine.
Yeah.
It is affirming.
We've had many.
It's affirming to hear that across the board, all the different religions are doing the same thing terribly.
You've heard
this. Scare the hell out of us.
Christian,
really.
Jewish, Hindu.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my.
Right. Very good.
Yeah. Well, I began tonight's show saying that the important thing about stories is the way they bring us together, the way they help us experience joy with one another. And I'm just delighted to have a couple of really good storytellers here tonight. And coming from one is on the show for the first time, one has been here five times. It's just been a joy for me to hear your stories and to get to know you guys. Brendan, I always have a thing with artists because artists don't get enough recognition in my view. I like to end the show by giving you a chance just to talk about some of your activities you have coming up, whether it's grown-up story time or landing theater or anything else.
Great. Yeah, I'd love to do that. Could somebody show me, like, our runtime? How much have we got left?
Well, about a minute and a half.
Okay, so the Landing Theater Company is going to do its New American Voices play reading series. That's where we pick plays from across the nation to and we have a panel pick the best four of them and put on a staged reading to promote new playwrights and new work.
Yeah.
And then we do our developmental reading series, which is where we take plays written by Houston playwrights and do staged reading of those. So everyone's invited. They're free. And finally, we do these micro plays inside houses, and I'll be writing one that we'll be staging in late spring, early summer of this coming year.
Cool. And tell us about Grown-Up Storytime.
Grown-Up Storytime happens at Rudyard's British Pub, second Tuesday of every month, and it's where anyone from the community can submit a story, and they hire a crack team of performers to read those stories in front of strangers at a bar, which sounds ludicrous, but it is in the most fun way possible.
Cool. Well, would you believe we're out of time? Sid and Brendan, thank you for being with us on So What's Your Story? Next week, Hank will host our good friend, Rabbi Seymour Rosell, whose off-the-chart storytelling skills are spotlight lessons of life, learning, and reflection. Read more about Rabbi Rosell later this week on our Facebook page, and you'll understand why it's a program not to be missed. Well, that's it for tonight. But don't touch that dial, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.